Welcome to the Christian Mysticism Podcast, where we explore the fascinating history of Christian mysticism from the early days of the church until today. I'm Alberto de la Cruz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Carlos Ayer, the T. Larson Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. Glad to have you back, Carlos.
Hi, it's good to be back. Always wonderful to be here.
Well, I hope you had a wonderful and happy and blessed Easter.
We did, yes. Thank you, and thanks be to God. Yes, the weather was beautiful, and the flowers are coming out, and it really feels like Easter in every way.
And the most important part, he is risen.
Yes, absolutely.
Before we get started on today's episode, I want to remind our listeners, if you haven't done it yet, please click the like button. Please subscribe. That'll help others find our show. And we want to appreciate all your support and all the wonderful emails our listeners have been sending us. So on this episode, I know it's a topic that is near and dear to you, Carlos, to me, and to a lot of our listeners.
Yes, St. Ignatius Loyola, one of the most important saints of modern Catholicism. He is important for so many different reasons. So we'll try to focus just on how he is significant for mysticism more than any of the other reasons that he's so important. But he was born 1491, died in 1556. But who was he? He was a Basque nobleman. Who are the Basques? Well, the Basques straddle the Pyrenees Mountains. Some are on the Spanish side, some are on the French side. He was born in an independent kingdom, actually, in 1491. Navarre was still an independent kingdom. It hadn't been absorbed by Spain yet. But of course, as he was growing up as a nobleman, he was expected to be a soldier, and that's what he was. And he was, by many descriptions, very much a party animal and a womanizer and a brawler, as well as a soldier. So he is one of these examples of someone who was not mystically inclined from an early age. And what happened is very, very interesting because he did not expect to have a conversion experience. But in 1521, he was fighting a battle against the French in the city of Pamplona, which is where they run the bulls every summer. So Pamplona was not far from his birthplace. He was defending Pamplona. But a cannonball almost amputated one of his legs and damaged the other one pretty badly. So he was out of the fight. And as was common back then, you know, where hospitals were few, he was sent home to recover. But it was a very, very, very long and painful recovery because the wounds were so horrible. And what happened was at one point, the leg that was shattered and almost blown off was not setting correctly. So it had to be rebroken and reset without anesthesia. Of course, they didn't have any such things back then. And that lengthened his convalescence, his recovery. And what happened next is remarkable in that it is so similar to the novel Don Quixote, and also similar to Teresa of Avila's childhood, because his favorite reading was in chivalric novels, just like Don Quixote and just like the young Teresa of Avila. So he found himself in bed all the time, bored to tears and in pain, and there were no chivalric novels for him to read. But there were two books there, and he started reading them. One of them was The Lives of the Saints, collection of the lives of the saints known as the Golden Legend by Jacopo Voragine. And they're short biographies of the saints. He starts reading that. And then there was another book there that we've dealt with before, The Life of Christ by Ludolf of Saxony, which is not a biography, but it's really a book of meditations on the life of Christ, where the reader is asked to actually get into the gospel story. Slowly, gradually, these books began to have an impact on him. And he switched, almost a complete switch over from wanting to be like all of the knights that he read about in chivalric literature, which is very much his aim, switched over to wanting to become a saint. And instead of wanting to engage in battles and be heroic, he started to say, for instance, I know this one, he wanted to be like Saint Francis. And then he also started doing these meditations that Ludolf of Saxony's book suggests. And the next thing you know, he has a religious conversion. And he comes out of it a changed man. But his family's not too happy. Of course, he's had no theological training of any kind. But from reading the lives of the saints and, you know, trying to model himself after some of the saints that he's read about and reading Ludolf of Saxony, he decides he's going to go to the Holy Land and see what goes next, see what happens next. He has to go to the Holy Land. So he leaves home and heads for Barcelona on the Mediterranean coast so he can catch a ship and go to the Holy Land. So he's off to the Holy Land. And this is one of the funniest stories I've ever read in the life of a saint. It goes to show you how much he was still his old self, despite the fact that he'd had a conversion, is that on the way to Barcelona, he runs into a Moor, a Muslim, who insults the Virgin Mary. Oh, and he has to restrain himself from defending the honor of the Virgin Mary. So he does nothing, but they get to a point where the Moor veers off, goes ahead of him, and then he starts thinking, I should have done something to defend the Virgin's honor. And he gets to a fork in the path, two roads. One road diverges into two. Which one should I take? Because he's intent on defending the Virgin's honor, which means probably, you know, attacking this person. And he gets to the fork in the road and he prays to God, oh, well, let it be your will, God. Whichever road I take, whether I end up defending the Virgin's honor or not, I'll leave it up to you. And of course, he takes the road that doesn't lead him to the Moor. But it's so funny, for me anyway, it was so funny that I first read this on an airplane and I started laughing out loud. And the person next to me saw what book I was reading and gave me the strangest look. The Autobiography of Ignatius Loyola. What am I laughing at? To cut to the chase, he ends up having deep religious experiences while praying, because he's praying a lot. And he ends up in a cave in a town called Manresa near Barcelona. And his hair grows long. His fingernails grow long. He doesn't bathe himself. He eats very, very little. And pretty much like Anthony in the desert, he starts to have some very intense experiences. And people in town think he's crazy. But finally, he has experiences that point him away from this weird life of a hermit. He wants to go to the Holy Land. And he ends up at the Shrine of Montserrat, which is a Marian shrine dedicated to the Virgin Mary. And he spends all night. And this again shows how his conversion was gradual. Offering his sword to the Virgin Mary at this shrine. Stays there all night praying, as knights do when they offer their sword to a lady before going off the battle. And he ends up in the Holy Land eventually, but can't stay there for very long. He ends up going back to Spain. But in the meantime, his mystical experiences have gotten very, very intense. And at a couple of points, also, as with St. Anthony in the desert, he's tempted by demons. And at two points in the narrative, he thinks of committing suicide because he's also undergoing dark night of the soul where God leaves him and he has no connection to God. So he lives through everything that we have discussed many times that happens in the lives of mystics. And these visions are pretty detailed as recorded in his autobiography. Here's one of them. Once while reciting on the steps of the monastery, this monastery he was staying at, the Little Hours, in honor of the Blessed Virgin Mary, his vision carried him beyond earth. He seemed to behold the Blessed Trinity in the form of a lyre or harp, and this vision affected him so much that he could not refrain from tears and sighs. And this became another hallmark of Ignatius's life as well as his spirituality. He had what is called the gift of tears, where he cried very often. His emotions took him to the point where he would simply just cry a lot. Here's another vision. At another time, to his great joy, God permitted him to understand how he had created this world. This vision presented to him a white object with rays emanating from it. From this object, God sent forth light. However, he could not clearly explain this vision, nor could he recall the illuminations given to him by God on that occasion. And a third one, because this brings us close to Manresa. One day he went to the Church of St. Paul, about a mile from Manresa. Near the road is a stream, on the bank of which he sat, and he gazed at the deep waters flowing by. While seated there, the eyes of his soul were opened. He did not have any special vision, but his mind was enlightened on many subjects, spiritual and intellectual. So clear was this knowledge that from that day everything appeared to him in a new light. Such was the abundance of this light in his mind that all the divine helps received and all the knowledge acquired up to his 62nd year were not equal to it. From that day, he seemed to be quite another man and possessed of a new intellect. This is what's known as infused knowledge, and we have seen it in other mystics too, including Anthony of the Desert. In many ways, his pilgrimage to Jerusalem and the part of it where he ends up just outside of Barcelona reads a lot like the life of Anthony, except he ends up doing something very different with his life. But he continued to have visions of this sort for the rest of his life. And his autobiography, which we'll get to in a few minutes, reads, consolations were sent to him in great number. On all his journeys, he received great supernatural visitations, like those he received at Manresa. So he goes to the Holy Land. It doesn't work. He comes back to Spain. He decides he needs to study theology. So first, he goes to the University of Alcalá, which was then a very new university. And he has to be in the classroom with men much younger than himself. Plus, that leg that was horribly injured never fully healed. So he limped for the rest of his life. And the younger students made fun of him because he wasn't that good at Latin. And he limped. You know, el cojo, the gimp. Gimpy, they called him, basically. But that's not as important as the fact that the Inquisition began to suspect that he was a heretic at Alcalá. And why would they suspect that he was a heretic? Well, there's two things. One, he was not an ordained priest, but he was counseling people religiously. Actually, he'd hang out on the street corner and try to lure people into conversations. And he would talk about whatever they were interested in and slowly, gradually switch over to religious issues and try to draw them in. He called this going fishing. I'm going fishing. I'm going to throw out a hook at people on the street. If you're a lay person, you're not supposed to do that. The other is, we have touched on this before in Spain at this time. The Inquisition was very keen on bringing in people who were known as alumbrados, or enlightened ones. And the charge against them was that they taught that you could get to a point of closeness to God. You became so enlightened that you became morally perfect, and nothing that you did could be a sin. Whether, in fact, this was alumbrado theology or not is still a question of great debate among scholars. Were all alumbrados the same? Did they all follow this kind of? It's not clear. But what's clear to me in a recent biography of Ignatius, it becomes very, very clear, and there's plenty of proof offered in it. Ignatius was pretty close to an alumbrado, not in the sinlessness charge against the alumbrados, but in the method of prayer he used, and which he advised people to practice, which was silent prayer, and to try to reach the prayer of quiet, where actually You're no longer using words, but basically God is praying with you and through you. So he's brought in by the Inquisition. He spent some time in the Inquisition prison, actually. So he leaves Alcalá and goes to the other big university, Salamanca, and the same thing happens there. So he has no choice but to leave Spain. And he goes to Paris to study theology there. And this is a big change. There's no Inquisition in Paris. He is very good at making friends, and just like Bernard of Clairvaux, convincing his friends that they too have to go on this spiritual quest with him. And from the nucleus of friends he establishes at Paris is the seed that grows into the order that he established, the Society of Jesus, better known as the Jesuits, which will be approved by the Pope 1540. And from that day on, the Jesuits just keep growing and growing in number, in influence, and Ignatius is right at the center of it. He will spend the remainder of his life basically in Rome as head of this order, and most of the writing that he did was letters. The man wrote letters constantly. He was managing so many things at once. You know, it's fair to say that the Jesuit order became the first global corporation. And I mean that literally, because the Jesuits sent missionaries all around the world. And keep in mind the dates we're talking about here. This is the first half of the 16th century. So the Spanish and the Portuguese especially are sailing to the New World, to the Americas, and the Portuguese especially are sailing to Asia. So Jesuit missionaries go out in all directions. And before long, by the time that Ignatius dies in 1556, the Jesuits are literally on just about every continent except Australia and Antarctica. Australia hadn't even been, quote-unquote, discovered yet. One of the most famous of these missionaries is St. Francis Xavier, a fellow Basque who was one of his closest and dearest friends and one of the very first to join him in Paris. Francis Xavier went to India, to Southeast Asia, and most famously to Japan. And he began the Christian missions to Japan. His dream was to go to China and convert the emperor, but he never got there. He died on an island off the coast of China from a very high fever, and he could not carry out his plan. But other Jesuits came after him, and the Jesuits, they established missions in China. But that's a whole other topic. And Francis Xavier was something of a mystic himself, too. So the Jesuits, they don't take over the world, but they become very, very successful missionaries, and they become also very great teachers, and they establish schools all over Europe, and they establish schools in the New World. And they also, by the second half of the 16th century, actually convert a high number of Protestants back to Catholicism, and mostly through their schools. And Poland is a good example. In Poland, they established schools at a time when a great number of Polish nobles had already become Protestants. And Poland was on the verge of going over to Protestantism. But they established their schools, and the nobles hear that the schools are so good, they start sending their children to the schools, to the Jesuit schools. And before you know it, all of those Protestant nobles become Catholic. And of course, Poland being a very feudal state at the time, if the nobles are Protestant, the peasants will start being pushed into becoming Protestants. If they're Catholic, then the peasants remain Catholic.
I've read a little history about Jesuits, which came after learning about Jesuits from the 20th century, which kind of is a little, I want to say a little different from the Jesuits we're hearing about now. Can you tell us a little bit about how its evolution, especially in the 20th century, and I'm referring to Jesuits in Latin America and the liberation theology movement, yeah, that kind of seemed to take over at least Jesuits in that region of the world.
Yes, that's one of, you know, several changes that the Jesuits have gone through. The Jesuits today are very different, even from the Jesuits who taught me in the early 1970s, because I went to a Jesuit university, Loyola, Chicago, and many of my professors were Jesuits. Well, that's especially true because I was a theology major, as well as a philosophy minor and a history major. But I would say that about a third of my professors were Jesuit priests, and they were very learned men, very good scholars, and very good teachers, too. But the focus in the Jesuit order at that time was still education. The Jesuits went into education. And most of their universities in the United States were actually opened to serve the arriving Catholic immigrants. You know, first generation, second generation immigrants, these Jesuit colleges and universities were for them, as was the case when I was going to Loyola, Chicago. Many of my fellow students were first generation college students. No one in their family had gone to college before. And many of them were immigrants. So what happened was that after Vatican II, after the Second Vatican Council, in Latin America especially, what ends up being called liberation theology takes root. And liberation theology focuses on questions of politics and economics and how they relate to the gospel, because the focus is poverty and poor people, the dispossessed. But liberation theology is definitely rooted in Marxist philosophy, and this has been proven numerous times, that the Soviet Union and the KGB had a hand in creating liberation theology. And it sort of became like a wildfire in Latin America and Latin American Jesuits, but then it spread to the whole order, and now the order as a whole is very much devoted to social ministries rather than education. And they still have a lot of colleges and universities, but there are ever a smaller and smaller number of men joining the order, becoming Jesuits, and becoming professors. So that's a big change. So Pope Francis is a good example of the direction taken by many Latin American Jesuits. Very different from these early Jesuits. But the history of the Jesuits from 1540 to the present, there's also another date and another huge change, which was 1773, when their order was abolished by the Pope, and the Pope and the Jesuits were expelled from all of the Western European countries and their colonies in Asia and the New World. Why? Well, the Jesuits by that time had become confessors to many of the royal families and the most important noble families, and they were also involved in the New World. They were actually trying to slow down and impede the way in which, especially the Portuguese in Brazil and the Spanish in Paraguay, were turning the natives into slaves without using the word slave. And the European powers, the first one to expel all Jesuits was Portugal, because the Jesuits were interfering with their colonization in Brazil. And how were they interfering? Well, they were actually bringing all the natives in to their missions and establishing what they called reductions, which meant that they were teaching the natives and they protected them and taught them European skills. And these reductions were untouchable. Portuguese couldn't touch them. They had reductions in Paraguay, and the Spanish were also stymied by the same thing. So before you know it, the Jesuits end up being disbanded for mainly political reasons, their involvement in the real world, in politics. And it's only because there were Jesuits in Ukraine and Russia, which was outside the Pope's authority, political authority. And they survived there. And enough of them survived that the order was restarted in 1815. And it went through this period where it almost ceased to exist. So the Jesuits have had their share of trouble, as well as troublemaking in their history. Unlike, let's say, the Benedictines, Cistercians, Franciscans, because of their commitment to education and to learning, the order, up until very recently, has been focused more on working in the world, being out there in the world, trying to change the world, trying to Christianize the world in a very intense way, rather than dedicating themselves, you know, for many, many hours of the day spent in prayer.
I didn't mean to sidetrack from St. Ignatius, but I remember a few years ago reading a book about St. Ignatius' spiritual exercises. And you may not recall this, but I reached out to you because I was reading some stuff and I was trying to figure it out, because in my mind, I think of Jesuits, I think of liberation theology, having, you know, that's my first experience with Jesuits has been that. And you sort of explained it to me. And I think maybe some of our listeners have the same experience that I had, where you have a limited knowledge of Jesuit history, and it's an order that has gone through several, as you've just mentioned, several evolutions and changes.
Yes, it has. And actually, the changes are also related to the fact that there are so many fewer men choosing the priesthood in the Catholic Church. And you can see that physically sometimes. The buildings, right? For instance, that the Jesuit order used to have to house all of the Jesuits who were in training, you know, who were still being educated and being trained for the priesthood. Some of these buildings were immense. There's a good example. One of these buildings is close to me. It's in Hyde Park, New York, which is just outside of Poughkeepsie. And it was the Jesuit novitiate for the, I forget, because they divided into provinces. I forget which was the name of the province, perhaps New York. Not sure. Anyway, an immense building. They needed an immense building, which looks pretty much like a large hotel, that kind of size. Well, it is now the Culinary Institute of America, where they train. Now, the Jesuits don't train the chefs. This is the school for chefs, one of the most famous in the United States. But now the numbers have gone down. And very interesting, they still have the Jesuit cemetery there, right outside the Culinary Institute. And it's locked. But if you go to the front desk of the Culinary Institute and you ask for the key to the cemetery, they have to give it to you. And you can go in and see all these identical tombstones with just the name on, name and dates. And one of them is one of the most famous theologians of the 20th century, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. So their history has gone through a lot. But Ignatius is central to the Jesuits to this day, no matter what they're doing. Ignatius and his spirituality, his mysticism, and especially his spiritual exercises, this remains so central to the Jesuit order to this day. Even though in other respects they have changed a lot, they have not changed in their absolute anchoring in Ignatius and his spirituality, and especially the spiritual exercises.
Well, we mentioned the spiritual exercises, which happens to be, if I'm not mistaken, probably his most widely read, most well-known text. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. It's not a book for reading, actually. And that, you know, it's a tough book to read. As a matter of fact, it's a tough book to teach, because what it is basically a guidebook for those Jesuits who will be leading other people, including young Jesuits in the making, leading other people through what Ignatius had himself gone through and experienced. And it is an extremely systematic approach to basically analyzing yourself, analyzing the deepest parts of your consciousness and your very being, and also figuring out how you can best relate to God and to the divine, and how you can find a godly purpose to your life. And it's not a very long book. it's divided into, of course, different exercises. And if you do it sort of the full effect spiritual exercises, it's divided into 4 weeks. It could take 4 weeks. There are shorter versions. And I have to admit up front for our listeners, I have never gone through the spiritual exercises. Even though I attended a Jesuit school and have known many Jesuits throughout my life, I have never gone through the spiritual exercises. But I can only imagine what it's like, because it can be really intense. And I know people whose lives have been changed by undergoing the spiritual exercises. But this will give our listeners a good idea of how traditional exercises are, as well as how novel they were for the 16th century. The traditional part is that the 4 weeks are divided into the three steps of the mystical path. First week is purgation. Second week is illumination. And the third and fourth week are about union. How mystical. What's novel about them is that the exercises are so similar to what modern psychology and psychiatry try to do with human beings. This searching in yourself, and you're supposed to go through your whole life, right? And figure out what steps you've been taking might not be right, trying to correct those. And one of the earmarks of the exercises are its meditations. So that also brings us back to the 16th century. The meditations like the ones proposed by Ludolf of Saxony. Put yourself there. Imagine this, imagine that. For instance, an exercise from the first week, which is a meditation on sin. And the first point, there are many points. It looks like an outline, right? It looks like an outline with bullet points when you actually pick up the spiritual exercises and look at a page. It's bare bones. But each one of those little components that look like an outline, they can go very deeply, and they can actually take up a lot of time. So for instance, the first point is the statement of the sins. That is to say, to bring to memory all the sins of life, looking from year to year, period to period. For this, three things are helpful. First, to look at the place and the house where I have lived. Second, the relations I have had with others. And third, the occupation in which I have lived. And the second point is to weigh the sins, looking at the foulness and the malice which any mortal sin committed has in it, even supposing it were not forbidden. The third point, to look at who I am, lessening myself by examples. Again, here we go again, the outline. First, how much I am in comparison to all men. Second, what men are in comparison to all the angels and saints of paradise. Third, what all creation is in comparison to God. Parentheses. Then, I alone? What can I be? Fourth, to see all my bodily corruption and foulness. And here we get more, this is not modern psychiatry, this is 16th century piety. Fifth, to look at myself as a sore and ulcer from which have sprung so many sins and so many iniquities and so very vile poison. Ooh. And it goes on. And you list your sins, and then you make for yourself a little chart to keep in mind, and you do this continually, a list of the sins that you want to eradicate from your life. And then you keep that list, and as you progress day by day, week by week, you cross them off when you think you have done away with them. Very systematic. But this digging into yourself, you know, reviewing your entire past life, that is key. And it's not much different from, what any therapist tries to do with a patient nowadays, whether they have an MD or not. This is the basic structure of therapy. And in many ways, you know, it's not much different from the 12-step recovery programs, which in many ways very similar to the spiritual exercises, where you begin by admitting right? You examine yourself and you admit what your faults are. I mean, I've never been to a 12-step program, but I've seen enough television shows and movies to know how it works. And I also read up on the 12 steps. I've never, you know, gone through it, but, you know, you admit, I am an alcoholic. First step in the spiritual exercises. I am a sinner and I have all these faults. And from there, you can proceed to the other weeks and other meditations. And perhaps the most famous or infamous, I should say, is the meditation on hell. And if you're going to fix yourself, you're going to try to do away with your worst faults, hell is always there on the horizon, because that's where mortal sins lead you, right? So here's the meditation on hell. The first point will be to see with the sight of the imagination the great fires and the souls as if bodies of fire. Yeah, the Spanish is very clear, but it's very difficult to translate. It's not bodies on fire, but the body itself becomes fire. Cuerpos ígneos. The second point is to hear with the ears wailings, howlings, cries, blasphemies against Christ our Lord and against all his saints. The third point is to smell the smoke, sulfur, dregs, and putrid things. Fourth, to taste with the taste bitter things like tears, sadness, and the worm of conscience. The fifth point, to touch with the touch, that is to say, how the fires touch and burn the souls. So notice these 5 points. You're using your 5 senses. You're putting yourself there in hell. And to tie this to a contemporary of Ignatius, Teresa of Avila, in her autobiography, she says that the most important turning point in her life was when God gave her a vision of hell. Very different from Ignatius, right? Ignatius's hell is more of the traditional hell where, you know, you have lots of people burning together, cursing God together. Now, Teresa's hell, as we've covered, was a stinking tiny alcove, like almost like a hole in the wall. Filthy, stinking, steaming, hot, suffocating, where she would have to spend eternity. It was a personal hell, Teresa's. Ignatius is more sort of the vast open hell, but he's asking you to use all your senses. And this is so typical of the exercises, right? Just involve yourself in there deeply, completely. Later on, in another week, there are all these meditations on the life of Christ, where you go through the entire narrative of all 4 Gospels, and you put yourself there in the story, just as he had read in the Life of Christ by Ludolf of Saxony. But all of this is supposed to lead to a point where you make a decision about what path your life is going to take. And of course, the person, the Jesuit, taking you through the exercises will help you try to figure out what the best path is for you. Because it's all about setting your life on the right path and choosing not just the right path, but discerning, being able to know what path God wants you to take, which basically boils down to the reason God put you on earth. So it could be a transformative experience, and I've known many people who have been transformed by going through the exercises. You know, what does this have to do with mysticism? Well, the very structure is purgation, illumination, and union. That discernment you're supposed to have at the end is because you've already gotten closer to God than you were at the beginning. And you're not figuring this out completely on your own, unaided. No, you're being helped by another human being. But more importantly, if this is done correctly, it's supposed to bring God into the exercises and God revealing to you what your path is.
Other mystics that we've covered here on the podcast, several of them have taught or instructed very similar concepts of placing yourself in the Gospels, placing yourself at the crucifixion, at the Passion of Christ, placing yourself in the room with Martha and Mary, placing yourself at the Last Supper and imagining what it's like. That's something that's almost a common thread among a lot of mystics.
Yes, it is. The mystic we dealt with in our last podcast, Maria Maddalena de Pazzi, she was very much into this. I mean, her very public ecstasies in which she was there at the crucifixion and other nuns are taking down what she's saying. Yes, it's pretty much the same. Yeah. And this is a form of meditation that really took off in this time period. It was developed in the Middle Ages, but it really took off in this time period, the early modern period. And the Jesuits, with their spiritual exercises, imagine, you know, they run these schools where, you know, I haven't said this yet, so I have to fill in this blank. The Jesuits are also innovators in education. They want to use the latest methods available for teaching. They want to ground the students in the best possible literature with an emphasis on ethics, the common good. But they also, for instance, the Jesuits become very well known for bringing in theater to their schools and having the students put on plays and learn through playing roles on stage a certain set of values in the plays that they perform, which all of them have a very, very deep, not just theological dimension, but an ethical dimension. And one of the things that the Jesuits did with the natives in their reductions in Paraguay was to teach them not just music, European music of the time period, teach them how to make the instruments. And in some of these reductions, so I have read, the instruments that were produced were just amazing. So they had a way of bringing people in, just like Ignatius went fishing on street corners in Alcalá. They went fishing in their schools for ways of trying to not just educate, but turn these students of theirs into good people, ethical people. Now that I think about it, the very beginning premise of the spiritual exercises, although it's similar to 12-step processes, you know, you admit what you've done wrong. You admit what's wrong with you. In many ways, that goes against our dominant culture, in which this can be viewed in our dominant culture, secular culture, as being too negative on yourself. But in fact, the 12-step process is also based to a great extent on hitting bottom, or what they call hitting bottom. When you hit bottom, you admit that you're seriously flawed, and you have to admit that so that you can become a better person. And basically, you know, if you reduce it to its barest essentials, this is what the spiritual exercises were about, with an added, of course, spiritual dimension. So could the spiritual exercises turn somebody into a mystic? Sure thing. They certainly could. But the spiritual exercises were not just about, you know, turning people into monks or Jesuits. No, it's about having people in the world who engaged with the world in as ethical a way as possible. And that's kind of hard to argue against.
Yes, it is. St. Ignatius also, obviously the spiritual exercises were a huge part of his ministry, but he also gave specific instructions on prayer.
Yes, he did. And I was just rereading it because it had been a long time, and it's truly amazing. Keeping in mind that he was accused of being an alumbrado, a prayer of quiet. But what he proposes in the spiritual exercises, several methods of prayer, but one of them in particular, I see it as what can flow out of this aim to engage in silent prayer and the effect it can have on you. And it's the third method of prayer which he proposes. And I'm going to read it. Third method of prayer is that with each breath, in or out, one has to pray mentally, saying one word of the Our Father or of another prayer, so that only one word be said between one breath and another. And while the time from one breath to another lasts, the attention be given chiefly to the meaning of such a word, or to the person to whom the prayer is being recited, or to your own baseness, or to the difference from such great height to your own so great lowness. There we go again, right? And in the same form and rule, he will proceed on the other words, whether it's the Our Father, other prayers, the Hail Mary, the Creed, or any other prayer that someone, of course, this is either a prayer that you can read or a prayer you have memorized word for word. But this business of just, you know, focusing on one word at a time and to doing it silently inside your head, combined with breathing, this ties Ignatius not only to the cloud of unknowing, which proposes the same thing about focusing on just one word. And actually, cloud of unknowing also says, you focus on God, say the word God over and over and over and over again, God, God, God. And then say the word sin over and over again, sin, 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 with meditations on sin, sin being yourself, you are sin. And the difference between God and you, you are sin, God is God, and so on. But it also ties Ignatius to the hesychast mystics of the Orthodox Church and their Jesus prayer and their method of breathing and this interval of time of the breath going in and the breath going out and saying the name of Jesus in between. Or even a longer set of words that you might meditate on, like Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. These methods persist through time because they work. And it's not just Christians or Christian mystics. Meditation is key to mysticism in all world religions. And actually, many people in the West are aware of this. In Indian religion, the idea of having a mantra, or, you know, a word or a phrase that you say over and over and over again, as a way of kind of derailing discursive reasoning. And it might bring you to enlightenment to say this word over and over again. So all these things kind of end up being linked together. Technical term, phenomenologically, they are so similar as phenomena that you can see that there's a very human and very practical dimension to this, that obviously it has worked for many. So you pass it on. You teach others to do it.
And that's what the Jesuits did, teach others. St. Ignatius was obviously a mystic. He experienced visions. And the way he developed these exercises, it becomes obvious that it's the same steps taken by other mystics from the early days of the church. So I would say everybody who does the spiritual exercises would become a mystic, but I don't think anybody would become a mystic without doing some type of spiritual exercises as put forth in his writings.
Yes. And I get asked this question frequently, especially when I teach my mysticism course, you know, what's the difference between someone taking a hallucinogenic drug, LSD, or even something more potent, mushrooms or ketamine or something, and, you know, having an experience that could be described as mystical. What's the difference between that and being a self-denying mystic of the monkish sort, Christian or non-Christian? What's the difference? Yeah, of course, it's lifestyle. Lifestyle makes all the difference. In all of the major religious traditions, mysticism means praying a lot and denying yourself pleasure a lot, examining yourself a lot, and abstaining from doing certain things and doing other things instead. That's not to say that, you know, somebody who takes LSD is not a religious person, but it's just very different.
Another great episode, Carlos. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, and I know our listeners appreciate it as well. So who do you have for us on the next episode?
Well, next episode, I think that we can perhaps stay in the same time period because there's so many things to tie together in this time period and focus on a saint from exactly the same time period who was known for not for writing texts or establishing religious orders, but rather had a very humble existence. And that is Saint Martin de Porres, Martin de Porres, a Peruvian who was obviously a mystic and experienced many of these physical phenomena that accompany mystical ecstasy, as well as perform very many miracles, and was very similar to Saint Francis. Saint Francis didn't write much either. Some of the mystics who end up having a strong influence on others and changing lives, they don't write much.
Well, it sounds like an interesting topic. Thank you again, and until the next time, thank you all for listening to the Christian Mysticism Podcast. If you have any questions for Dr. Ayer, you'll find our email address in the show notes. Just send it over and we'll try to answer it in a future episode. And don't forget to click the subscribe button so you don't miss the next episode of the Christian Mysticism Podcast.